you hear me? Can you hear me in the back? How's that? Okay. If you can't hear me, say so. I didn't know that Deborah was going to say anything about the chef part, but you know, sort of the scenes of food in this book are relatively disturbing. First of all, thank you for inviting me to be here. And again, I think I'm okay. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this book. I don't usually talk about my mother either when I come and do things like this, but when I told my mother I was going to review this book, she yelled at me. She hated this book so much that she just was livid that I would stand up here and actually that I liked the book. I mean, she hated the violence of it, and on the darkness of it, and yeah, it was very interesting. I mean, she hasn't yelled at me in a long time, but she yelled at me about this, and this is, you know, a woman who made me read The Iliad when I was 8 years old or something. Well, it's like one of the most blood-soaked books in the world as well, so I'm not really sure. I think it's just a little too close. So I'm very interested, though. I mean, I say that, anecdotally, but I'm very interested in that response to the book, in that response to the extreme violence, and a lot of McCarthy, right? To the extreme violence, to the extreme darkness sometimes of the texts, and how at the same time there's a compelling nature, right, to the writing itself that moves one through, but also absent a kind of Shakespearean catharsis or something. There's, you know, in the sort of Shakespeare play with also blood-soaked plays, you end up with a sense of order towards the end, and I don't think in McCarthy you ever achieve that. And that was also something that struck me because my mother loves to read Shakespeare and the most gruesome, you know, anyway. But she won't read this book, and she yelled at me. So with that, let me move on. Again, that's part of what I'm trying to figure out in my own response to McCarthy. I like McCarthy. I've been reading McCarthy for a long time, though I'm put off by it at the same time in a lot of ways. I mean, scenes of humans stashed in the basement, right, waiting to be eaten in this book, I mean, by other humans because there's no other food is... it's a disturbing image. How can you say you like that? Right at the same time where I find the book compelling. So I want to try to get into that a little bit later. First of all, what I'd like to do is I'll just give you a little background. I'll just give you a little list of McCarthy's books. I'll give you a little background about his life, if that's okay, right? A little bit of his biography. I'll give you a little bit, some of the reviewers' responses to McCarthy. Then I'll take off and sort of march through the book in a way that I think is beneficial. I'll read from the book to an extent. So the books, The Orchard Keeper, 1965, Outer Dark, 1968, Child of God, 1973. He's publishing regularly for a long time. The Gardener's Son, which is a screenplay, a PBS screenplay, Sutri in 1979, which I think is my favorite book. Sutri is set in Knoxville. It's the most autobiographical of his books. It's the son of a wealthy family kind of slumming all over the riversides in Knoxville. Sort of knocked James Agee's book, A Death in the Family, I think it's called, as the most famous Knoxville novel. I don't think there are many famous Knoxville novels, but right, this one sort of took the wind out of James Agee's sails. So I think McCarthy is sort of, you know, he's the heir to James Agee in some, not in style, but at least, you know, in Knoxville culture. Following in 1985 is Blood Meridian. How many people have read Blood Meridian? Yeah, that's also sort of like a hard book, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of violent. But what Blood Meridian does, I think, it really kind of puts McCarthy on the map as a Western writer in some ways, right? Takes him out of you know, the scenes of most of his earlier work, which is the Southeast, right? But it does Blood Meridian does something else, I think, very important and typical for McCarthy, and something I think he does with The Road as well, in taking the myth of the West, right? This powerful myth that we have in the United States of the Wild West and of settling the West and conquest, right? Blood Meridian is a book based on historical fact, on researched historical fact. Some of the characters were real people. Judge Holman was a real person, right? This is a band of bloodthirsty Indian scalp hunters that are working for the Mexican government, right, just going out and massacring Indians and taking scalps for money. What McCarthy, I think, does by pointing up this sort of incident, and this is a very difficult book to read, but it does sort of revise our Western myth, right, that whole idea of the cowboy moving into the West and this rugged individual. It gives us the seamier side of that and complicates our sort of westering behavior in a way that I think is important. And then following that, All the Pretty Horses, you know, followed in quick succession, The Crossing, The Cities and the Plain, those are the ones that a lot of people know, the Border Trilogy, right? And All the Pretty Horses won the National Book Award, National Book Critics Circle Award, was made into a film. What's interesting to think about if you've read those three books, that the last book, The City of the Plain, had existed for, say, at least 10 years before he began All the Pretty Horses. It existed as a screenplay that he was shopping around in Hollywood, right, that he couldn't get anyone to produce. So that's how the final book really was the first one written, in a sense, and then it becomes, right, that novel. Then, following Cities of the Plain, No Country for Old Men, which, as everybody knows, will be out any time as a Coen Brothers film, which has gotten rave reviews. And then a novel in dramatic form called The Sunset Limited, 2006, and then The Road, 2006, winning the Pulitzer Prize. McCarthy was born on July 20th, 1933, in Rhode Island. When he was four, his family moved to Knoxville, which again is the setting for Sutri. He was raised Catholic, and he went to Catholic schools, and I think that some of this, there's a lot of, some of that language, some of the language of Catholicism, and certainly biblical language, plays into The Road. 1951 to 52, he was at the University of Tennessee. 53 to 57 in the Air Force. After that, he returns to Tennessee. And during the middle 60s, McCarthy was sort of this wild character that, you know, sort of kept to himself. We don't really know much about his biography anyway, because he's very private. But he married twice in the early to middle 60s, had a son with his first wife, whose name is Lee Holman, who's actually a poet, still publishing as Lee McCarthy. He traveled to Europe, met his second wife, who was a dancer on the ship as he went over to Europe. You know, hung out with her for quite a long time. They lived in Ibiza, which, you know, now is like a sort of, industrial rock hangout for young people. At that time, I think it was more of an artist colony. But during this time, he wins the Rockefeller, the Guggenheim, and this is how he survives, really. And he doesn't make a lot of money. He's never really published widely until, really, All the Pretty Horses came out. Much of his time in the U.S. was spent living in Tennessee. And I thought this was an interesting fact. When McCarthy was renovating a barn in Tennessee for his home, he learned that James Agee's boyhood home in Knoxville was going to be pulled down. And so he went there and he scavenged the bricks from James Agee's house to build his own fireplace. Right? So this is, again, this, you know, the guy who he takes over from as right the Knoxville novelist. But anyway, he got his bricks for his fireplace from this guy. 76, moves to El Paso, Texas. 81, MacArthur Foundation grant. And again, you know, I think the move also, I mean, the physical move to Texas, I think he lives in New Mexico now, the physical move to Texas and somehow facilitates, right, his picking up of the West as the scene for his novels, although in The Road we come back to the South, right? That's, you know, crossing the Appalachians into the Piedmont to the sea. But I'll talk a little bit about that, right? He claims that he, you know, when he was talking about All the Pretty Horses, and which he, as we know, had great success from that, McCarthy said that he made enough money from that novel to buy a new pickup truck, right, which is, right, is sort of, you can't really trust everything he says. And he's only been allowed 3 interviews in his life as well. I mean, he's, you know, he's not a young guy. He's only allowed 3. The most recent one you can find, you can watch on the web. It's on Oprah's book club website, right? And actually you can watch the interview, which is pretty interesting. That's the only time I ever went to Oprah's thing. But yeah, it was worth it. I was sort of impressed, actually. Yeah. Again, what else did I want to say about him? Oh yeah, his favorite book is Moby Dick, right? So he's like me in that way, I guess. So I like him for that. But Melville's language, right? I think the kind of effusive language that one finds in Melville and in Moby Dick is also evident in McCarthy. And I wanted to make one more mention about this brief biography. And basically, the biography I gave you in a nutshell isn't much more than what anybody knows about McCarthy. Right? He's not well known. People don't. He stays to himself. At Random House, where he published first at Random House. At Random House, from 1965 to the 1990s. His publisher was Albert Erskine, who was also Faulkner's publisher. He was Faulkner's editor, right, throughout Faulkner's whole career. And Erskine took up McCarthy early on, right, and worked with him all the way through the 90s. So that's a really interesting sort of connection as well. And you can see that connection. I think of all people, you can see in his work Faulkner, right, showing through here, for sure. And he's very self-conscious about that as well. And up about that. He says that, you know, in an interview I was looking at not long ago, he says, frankly, novels are made from other novels, right? That you don't just sit up and make a novel, you know, you get to write a novel by, right, reading other novels. So in the sense that the novels are always built from what comes before. Erskine, interestingly, was also Ralph Ellison's editor. You know, he sponsored Invisible Man. And that's an interesting connection, too, right, this kind of underground existence. And, of course, about all this, McCarthy says that he chose Random House because it was the only house that he ever heard of, right? He said he didn't know of any other publishing houses, so he sent it there, which I don't think I believe. But anyway, that's what he says. He says in this Oprah, and I always feel a little self-conscious talking about Oprah, but he says in this interview with Oprah that he wrote The Road, which, as we know, won the Pulitzer. He says he wrote it in a few weeks. He said he thought about it, you know, for a few years and then sat down and just wrote it in a few weeks, right? Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, that's what he says, I guess. You have to believe it on some level, but on the other hand, some of the attention to language in the book is so meticulous that it's hard to believe. And the other thing that interests me about this comment is that, again, to make this Faulkner connection, when Faulkner wrote As I Lay Dying, right, he wrote it, well, this is what he claims, too, right, that he wrote it while he was working in the physical plant at the University of Mississippi, and he claims that he wrote it on, you know, an upside, he turned the wheelbarrow upside down that he used to bring the coal in, and he turned the wheelbarrow upside down, and that was his desk. And that he wrote it in 6 weeks, right? And that's what he says. And he says, but he says, I knew every word before I put it down on paper. If you go back and look at the transcripts of As They Lie Dying, you know that maybe the first one went, you know, was 8 weeks. And he did go back and correct it. But This is also very interesting. This is, I think, in some way, it's a very self-conscious alignment with Faulkner in this. Oh, yeah, I sat down and wrote, you know, it took me 3 weeks to write this thing, where Faulkner, you know, says, I wrote this, but I knew every word before I sat down. He said, Faulkner said, before I put the first word on the page, I knew what the last word was going to be. Right, that was his way of talking about it. So I don't think anybody writes that way, but it's the parallel to me is interesting. I want to just take a second and read a couple of reviews. Then I'll go back and I'll point out some themes that I think are important, and then I'll read some passages. And then hopefully we can open up the discussion. How many people have read the book? Did I already ask you that? No. Okay, good. The San Francisco Chronicle calls The Road a tale of survival and a miracle of goodness. I don't know. I'm not so sure about the goodness part. It's definitely a tale of survival, and there's definitely some goodness, but I'm not sure how miraculous it is in here. The NPR critic, Alan Chu, says that McCarthy could turn the instructions to operate a microwave into something resembling the King James Bible. Right. Which I thought is perfect, right, if you think about his language. And in this book, where he talks about dismantling little stoves and putting them back together, all these little minute details that show up in here. And the book is filled with this kind of stuff, right? How to determine the length of rope, right, by looking at the coils and without uncoiling it, right, by looking at the coils. And maybe that's something that sailors know how to do, but it seemed to that bit of information seem interesting to me in the book. But those kinds of details are meticulous in the book. Also, Shoes calls The Road, excuse me, which I think is maybe a perfect description of it, a black book of wondrous paragraphs, right, which I think is also interesting. And he claims it a triumph of language over nothingness. And I think that's important, though, and I want to talk some more about that, because I think what and when I read this review, this brief review, I was interested in that, because I think what happens in The Road is that the only thing that really does survive, I mean, okay, the child survives, but I think what survives most overpoweringly in the book is the language itself, right? Is the weighty, beautiful language itself. I guess beauty isn't the right word, but the sort of stark dignity of despair, maybe, that surfaces through the language in the book, and that implies some sort of writer, some sort of maker, some sort of God I don't want to say like a God, like the writer's a God, but the God that's missing, I think, in this book, right? Everything's missing in this book except maybe here, then language. I think language becomes very, very important, and it resonates through here. The guy from Mark Holcomb from the Village Voice also points, and I picked some of these reviews out because I think that they bring up cogent points. He says, and now listen to this, I think this is important. He says its argument exists in the tension between the rank self-centeredness necessary to survive as an individual and the altruism required to survive as a species. Right? And that seems really interesting to me about this book, in that, you know, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, but you always are torn between, right, how selfish an individual needs to survive in these kinds of circumstances, but also, right, how you can't survive without, you know, some sort of altruism going on. So I think that is also right to the mark. Janet Maslin of the New York Times says that the imagery is brutal even by Cormac McCarthy's high standards for despair. And The Road would be pure misery if not for its stunning savage beauty. And this, I thought, was a pretty wry comment as well. She says, since the cataclysm has presumably incinerated all dictionaries, Mr. McCarthy's affinity with words like rachitic and crozzled has as much visceral atmospheric power as precise meaning, right? And this is interesting, right? It's not so much precise meaning, but it's this language, like something like Krozzled. Whoever, you know, I mean, I had to look up Krozzled for sure, right? You know, it's like a burnt ember left from a making iron, right? You know, that's a Krozzled. This, again, seems right in the mark, and I want to talk about that a little bit more, about how the imagery works. Just to give you, those of you that haven't read it, a little, just a bit of the plot. The plot is basically, I mean, if you don't know it, it's the end of, right? There's some kind of cataclysm has happened. You've never explained what. I think it's pretty clear it's a nuclear devastation. And the Earth is basically dying. There is no vegetation left, really. Everything is burnt off. The cities are burnt shells. There's no food. And a man and his young boy are trying to get to the sea. To see, they're marching southwest across the Appalachians. They cross the Appalachians into the Piedmont, and they're marching toward the sea. I guess hoping to find something there. Of course, the sea is dead when they get there as well. But what they're trying to find is never really clear, right? I mean, what do you do in this situation? You march down the road. The road, of course, is populated by marauding bands of cannibals and other otherwise horrible, unspeakable people, right? Barely human people anymore, who, you know, predatory people. So, and there are very few people left in the world as well. And what you get is you get this intense bond between a man and his son as they move down the road. The other part of the book that's interesting is that these characters are never named, right? It's the man and the boy, or the son, or they have no names. You don't get anybody's name. So one name that I can remember in the book, and that's the old man, the old prophet Eli, right, who shows up, and his name is Eli. Eli, of course, is the, in the biblical sense, right, was a judge of Israel who didn't punish his two reprobate sons, right, and then God, for punishment, visited destruction on Israel. And this is also, they're destroyed by the Philistines, and they take the ark. The ark is removed from the first time out of the tabernacle, right, under Eli. So that name resonates through the book as well, except for then the guy Eli in the book says, that's not really my name. So, you know, you make these kinds of connections, and McCarthy always sort of short-circuits them. But basically, that's the point. I mean, that's the plot of the book. It's that simple. Well, it's not that, well, it is simple, but it gets complicated. But this idea, again, when I was mentioning about McCarthy taking on, right, this notion of, with Blood Meridian, this notion of the myth of the West, and I know that Carrie Ahern was here talking about On the Road a couple months ago, right, that's the other huge, right, American metaphor, right, the road, right, we're going to go on a road trip. Our literature is filled with, right, novels and poems and all kinds of things. Think of movies, right? I mean, all the way from, right, the narrative of Mary Rowlandson when she's marching around, right, 17th century New England captured by Indians, to Thelma and Louise or whatever you want to talk about, right? I mean, the road thing. And so this is also taking on that notion, and this is part of the power of McCarthy, again, is his ability to take on these American traditions, I think, and change them in a way. Of course, by the time this book comes, by the time the road shows up, there's no more America to mythologize, right? And that's part of the trajectory of the book. There's no more nothing, right? There's really no more nothing. It is a book whose palette consists almost entirely of grays and blacks. The whole book, right? There is a blue tarp that you see sometimes that the rain patters on, and the kid has a yellow truck, and when he finds a, you know, a wrecked boat, the guy gets, right, he finds some foul weather gear in there, which presumably is, or yellow, I guess, I don't know, it doesn't say what color, but for the most part, the book's palette is entirely gray and black, and it's a dark, dark book. Again, I mentioned this before, I was going to look at this. I'll talk a little bit more about the language, but I'm interested in this powerful bond of love between the Father and the Son, and this is also a compelling part of the book, again, the bond itself between the Father and the Son. The bond standing up against all odds is, I think, universalized by the fact that the characters don't have names. The flip side to this is, however, right, that the two of them are to survive, if anybody's to survive, right, they need each other. It's a bit of a conundrum. I mean, do we survive because we love one another, or do we need to love one another in order to survive? And I think this is questioned throughout the book. It's never answered. The other thing about McCarthy, and very often people are critical about McCarthy in this sense, is that these bonds in McCarthy are very often between, and they are in this book too, they're between men, right? And women seem to vanish from the text fairly soon, right? The wife here makes a, she shows up, but, you know, she vanishes fairly soon. And I think that's, I don't really know what to say about that. I know that my wife liked the book a lot, but that's not really any kind of scholarly engagement with that thing. But I think that McCarthy in some ways is a very masculine writer, and I could see how people could be put off by that lack of a woman's presence in there. Though there is a tender passage where he says he's thinking back, and he says he could remember everything of her save her scent, seated in a theater with her beside him, leaning forward, listening to the music. Gold scrollwork and sconces and the tall columnar folds of the drapes at either side of the stage. She held his hand in her lap, and he could feel the tops of her stockings through the thin stuff of her summer dress. Right? And so juxtaposed then into this brutal narrative are once in a while little images like this that almost shock you into tenderness in a way, which you would think it should be the other way around. But on top of that, though, the father also, you know, there is this tender kind of relationship between the father and the son. But the father also, and I thought this was a very interesting point, thought of his boy as, and given the context, and this is a direct quote, a creation perfectly evolved to meet its own end. Right, and I think talking about the human condition, not just, you know, not just his son. Right from the beginning, I think the book denies hope by negating our oldest metaphor of hope. And I'll get to the passages. I'll read the passages here. I don't want to take up the whole time. Let me repeat that. Right from the beginning, the book denies hope by negating our oldest metaphor of hope, the appearance of light in the east. Right from the beginning, what happens? The sun doesn't ever rise, right? I mean, it lightens in the sky somehow, but the sun doesn't rise. That's our, right? Isn't that our, or some of our earliest, at least, right, our thought of hope, that the sun comes up, or, well, yeah. It comes up in Bend. Yeah. It's sort, you know, it shows up here. It gets light out anyway. Yeah. But on the other hand, so it begins with that metaphor of the sun not rising. But on the other hand, so you have that negation of that hope. Yet, on the other hand, his child is with him, right? That's our other metaphor of hope, right? The child with us. So he negates it and sets it up at the same time. And this is consistent throughout the book. And this to me is very, very interesting, in which, right, this is kind of our human tension, right? It's hope in the face of hopelessness and all kinds of other things. This tension is sustained throughout the novel. There are five prominent scenes, probably a couple more, and I'm not going to read them all, but there are five prominent scenes where they're on the road and they, you know, one got, you know, people try to kill them or people steal their things and they're threatened. And the father responds, right, they have a pistol with two bullets, right, that they're carrying along with them. He kills one guy early on, so through most of the book, what they have is a pistol with one bullet in it, and that's usually he gives to the boy, because he has taught the boy how to kill himself if the father is killed. But what happens is, in these extreme situations, when the father and the son meet with some sort of enemy or some sort of threat on the road, the father's reaction is to kill, right? Or to ignore, not to help. There are a couple places where there's one place where the boy sees another young boy running off in the alley. There are other places where people are stashed in the basement. And the boy says, we should help, right? We should help. But the father says, no, we need to survive. And that's right back, right, to that passage I read from the critic, right? The rank self-centeredness you need to survive, and the altruism that you need to survive as a species are set up in this kind of dichotomy between the father and the boy, right? The boy is the one that has empathy, that still has empathy. No one else in the novel still has empathy, I don't think. And the boy is also figured at different times as a god, right? Or as a savior figure. It's very oblique, but there's a part where, you know, he talks about, they always talk about carrying the fire, but there's a part where he talks about the boy being, right, a tabernacle and the light moving around him and different kinds of ideas. So that notion, at least five times in the novel, right, it's not that big of a novel, so spread out throughout five separate scenes in which this tension happens between the father and the son. So I would argue that in some ways, right, and given all the horrible, blood-soaked, black atmospherics of the book, that these tension points are really the part where, right, I think where McCarthy is trying to say what he wants to say, in that this is art in extremes, and for McCarthy, I think he would say that the world is always in extremes, right, but this is the sort of tensions we need to work out, right? I think Cormac McCarthy himself is probably more likely to shoot somebody than to show empathy, but I think he's wise enough to say that, you know, that the other is possible or necessary. I just want to just say what happens, and I'm going to read a little bit what happens in the book, and I want to talk about just about registers in the book and the sounds and the notions of different discourses, or I don't even want to say discourses, but styles. Southern Gothic, right? Faulkner, right? Flannery O'Connor, those voices, right, are in here. Melville's in here, right? That kind of language. The Bible, especially the prophetic tradition in the Bible, is everywhere. Right, it's throughout this book. It's the King James, right? The reviewer that talked about the King James Bible was right on. It's all through here. There are traces of the grapes of wrath in here, right? The road trip, right, from gray disaster to some other disaster in California, right? That's going on. And there's, I hear in there even a bit of Yeats, you know, and what rough beast its hour come at last slouches towards Bethlehem to be born, right? The second coming, that also apocalyptical poem. So the other thing that happens, and just into the text, oh, I am running out of time. Okay, I'm talking too much, is that very often the way that the language is constructed, that the book is filled with fragments. Right, it's filled with sentence fragments, and it uses, I don't want to use a big English professor word, but parataxis, right? There's no subordination, there's almost no subordination in the book. Like, its ideas are connected by ands, not by causes or other kinds of clauses. All this stuff, and, which is biblical, which is, you know, sort of King James-like, but the effect of this is that the imagery is cumulative. It piles up. Instead of one thing being subordinated to the next, it's just a pile. Sorry. That's like the English professor thing too, right? So swinging your hands around. It just piles up and piles up. So I think that's very, very, very important as far as the construction of the book. And I think that imagery, instead of being one image more important than the next, images and words are seen as very material-like things, just placed next to each other, on top of each other, thrown into a pile or built into a wall. And so I'll just read a little bit, and then we'll have questions. Is that good? Yeah? Okay. So I'll read a little bit from the beginning. When he woke in the woods in the dark and the cold of the night, he'd reached out to touch the child sleeping beside him. Nights dark beyond darkness and the days more gray, each one than what had gone before. Like the onset of some cold glaucoma dimming away the world. His hand rose and fell softly with each precious breath. He pushed away the plastic tarpaulin and raised himself in the stinking robes and blankets and looked toward the east for any light, but there was none. That's the beginning, right? This is the beginning of the book. This is when you, like, throw it out the window. Yeah, I know, yes, in some ways, but for some reason it pushes you on. In the dream from which he'd wakened, he had wandered in a cave where the child led him by the hand. And right at the beginning in this sentence, he's using, in two times he uses he'd, right, H-E apostrophe D, and then the next time he uses it, two words later, he says he had. Right, so he uses a contraction one time, and for a word saying the exact same thing, uses he had. What he's doing here is he's setting up a rhythm. It's like writing a poem, right? He's setting up a rhythm, and the he had, right, resonates with wandered, he'd, wakened, wandered, had, right, all these poetic sounds. So the language right from the beginning is constructed very, very self-consciously. It makes it very difficult to think that I've sat down and wrote it in 3 weeks. Like pilgrims in a fable swallowed up and lost among the inward parts of some gigantic beast, deep stone flues where the water dripped and sang, and so on. Let me see here. And here's an image of, this is filled, right, with fragments, and this is the image of the dark when I talked about the palette of the book. The blackness he woke to on those nights was sightless and impenetrable. The nights are so dark because the sky is filled with ash, right, and blowing ash. On those nights was sightless and impenetrable. A blackness to hurt your ears with listening. Often he had to get up. No sound but the wind in the bare and blackened trees. He rose and stood tottering in that cold, autistic dark, with his arms outheld for balance, while the vestibular calculations in his skull cranked out their reckonings. An old chronicle to seek out the upright, no fall but preceded by declination. He took great marching steps into the nothingness, counting them against his return. Eyes closed, arms oaring. Wonderful image. Upright to what? Something nameless in the night, load or matrix, to which he and the stars were common satellite, like the great pendulum in its rotunda, scribing through the long day movements of the universe, of which you may say, it knows nothing, and yet know it must. And then a little bit more of a description about what it's like there. By he's telling a little bit of history. By then, all stores of food had given out, and murder was everywhere upon the land. The world soon to be largely populated by men who would eat your children in front of your eyes, and the cities themselves held by cores of blackened looters who tunneled among the ruins and crawled from the rubble white of tooth and eye, carrying charred and anonymous tins of food in nylon nets, like shoppers in the commissaries of hell. The soft black talc blew through the streets like squid ink uncoiling along a seafloor, and the cold crept down, and the dark came early, and the scavengers passing down the steep canyons with their torches trod silky holes in the drifted ash that closed behind them silently as eyes. out on the roads, the pilgrims sank down and fell over and died, and the bleak and shrouded earth went trundling past the sun and returned again as trackless and as unremarked as the path of any nameless sister world in the ancient dark beyond. That's the sort of, but the language is impressive. The language is really, really impressive. And you noted in that last piece I read, all the ands. There's tons of them. The book is filled with them. And it piles up. I just wanted to, let me find this one more page that I wanted to read. He says somewhere in here, I don't have the page right in front of me about that, in this world there were no more God-spoke men. No more prophets. Anyway, the one part that I wanted to just take a look at was that, there again, this is one of the instances where the father and the son are debating over whether to help somebody. "He's not gone," the boy said. He looked up, his face streaked with soot. "He's not. What do you want to do? Just help him, Papa. Just help him." The man looked up the road. "He was just hungry, Papa. He's going to die. He's going to die anyway. He's so scared, Papa." The man squatted and looked at him. "I'm scared," he said. "Do you understand? I'm scared." The boy didn't answer. He just sat there with his head bowed, sobbing. "You're not the one who has to worry about everything." The boy said something, but he couldn't understand him. "What?" he said. He looked up. His wet and grimy face. "Yes, I am," he said. "I am the one. And I am the one." And there is a sense that that the boy is some sort, right? "I am the one. I'm the one," right? That biblical resonance, right? And then just one more passage to support that. I'm trying to, at least give you some hope at the end, right? I hope I'm not completely straining my argument. But he says, they talked hardly at all. He coughed all the time. Father is dying. He coughed, right? He coughed all the time, and the boy watched him spitting blood, slumping along, filthy, ragged, hopeless. He'd stop and lean on the cart there. By the way, they're pushing. They have all their belongings in a shopping cart that they push down the road. This whole thing is, and it gets stolen periodically, but this is how they live, right? They have everything in the shopping cart. He'd stop and lean on the cart, and the boy would go on and then stop and look back, and he would raise his weeping eyes and see him standing there in the road, looking back at him from some unimaginable future, glowing in that waste like a tabernacle. Right. And so that's my, that's part of my thinking, that even though this is a gruesome book, there is, I think, that glowing tabernacle in the wilderness, right, which is, of course, another enormously biblically resonant image that leaves us at least with a modicum of hope, I think, at the end of the book. Hope, hopelessness in the same, I think, confronted in the same thing, right? So, okay, I think that's all I want to, I think I said enough about the book, anyway. Thank you. Question? Yeah.
I'm curious as to what you thought about the fact that the boy had never seen Earth before the event. When I got to that part in the book, I couldn't help but think about it through the whole rest of the book. That
right.
This father was with a son who never knew Earth before this event happened.
Right, right. That shows up, I think, periodically in the book when the boy wants the father to tell him a story, right? And the father doesn't want to tell the stories because it's, right, he says they're not true. And I think that what interests me in the book is not only that, but there, you remember when there's a scene in the book when he goes to the library, right? And he finds all the books soaked on the ground, and he looks at them and he says that he didn't realize that the smallest thing, the smallest idea, depended on the future for it to have any meaning at all, right? And so in that sense, there's no past and there's no future, right? And that's part of something that's going on in this book, too. There's a place, right? But there's very little history, and there's a really doubtful future. And that part about the kid growing up with no stories, remember, he remembers his mother a little bit, right? And he somehow knows how to play with the truck, and he sees the boy, and remember, there's a part where he remembers that the father was going to kill a dog when he says, "Don't kill the dog," right? And so he has this vague remembrance, but I don't really know what to say beyond that anymore, except for I think that what McCarthy is going to argue for, where that takes me in my imagination, is if there is a future, it's one without a past. Which is because the past has all been, and that goes two ways, I guess, you know. If the past of his remembrance is a past that was capable of destroying the world, then perhaps he's better off without that history, you know. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question at all? Yeah.